Hey guys, Harrison Wormackaddock once again with a brand new podcast for you, and welcome to episode 6 of the Motorsport 101 podcast. I'm your friendly neighbourhood host, Andre Harrison. Alongside me we have our usual co-host, Mr. Ryan King.
Hello everyone.
How you doing, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good.
Doing pretty good. yeah, been a pretty hectic weekend of sport. Obviously, you know, we had the Ballon d'Or votes just come through. Cristiano Ronaldo is apparently the world's best football player again, even though we're both pissed it wasn't Manuel Neuer. God damn it. We had a ridiculous Formula E race, which we'll be talking about in a little bit, because God damn, you may never see a race like that again. And all sorts of fun stuff as well. And yeah, we would even have an impromptu Susie Wolf update at the end of the show, because, God damn it, we're stealing the finish line's gimmicks. Because, trust me, this story is so funny, I've got to get this in. I heard this before we went on the air, and it was hilarious, and now I have to include it, it's by law. So, for the full run on episode 6, we're going to be talking about Formula, like we mentioned before, Formula E in Argentina, in what was an early contender for race of the year. I don't know how anything tops that for excitement this year. It was an absolutely ridiculous race in Argentina. We'll be covering that later, as Antonio Felix da Costa became the fourth different winner in Formula E this season after the first four races. We'll also be dabbing a little bit with the Frank Montagne drug bust after he admitted taking cocaine while in Malaysia, which, in case you didn't know their laws, isn't entirely a good idea. Also, we'll be talking about the engine regulations and the rules that are in-season development, to a degree, is allowed in Formula 1 this season throughout 2015, but it's not as big a deal-breaker as you think it is, and I still wouldn't hold that much hope for Ferrari or Renault in that regard, but we'll cover that later. And also why Honda may not have as much of an advantage as you may think, or if any at all, for that matter. And we'll also be talking about the super license changes. It turns out the FIA have announced a radical new scoring system to decide which drivers are eligible for an F1 super license and not. We'll be breaking that down, whether it's fair, whether it's unfair, whether it's a better system, during that part of the show. So, let's get down to it for episode 6 of Motorsport 101, and let's get into Formula E in Argentina, round 4 of the Formula E Championship. Around Buenos Aires, Argentina's capital city, great turnout, fans were loving it. Like, even I remember at one point, like, we had the safety car in the middle of the race, and you could visibly hear the Argentina fans cheering all over the place, even though the cars are moving at about 14 miles an hour. So you can't fault Argentina for their enthusiasm. But yeah, it turns out Antonio Felix da Costa, I think was what I like to call the scrappiest scrapper in the scrap, essentially, for winning what was a ridiculously hell-raising Grand Prix right from the first corner, King.
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible race, incredible environment. I still feel that Formula 1 should go back to Argentina, because it was kind of crazy to hear fans singing in the stands.
Wow, I've never heard that before in all the years I've been watching Formula 1, fans singing. Like, I must have been a cool experience for Jarno Trulli, who actually was in Formula 1 the last time they raced there in 1998. As Jack Nicklaus pointed out on commentary. Yeah, but right from the first corner, we had Nick Heidfeld get off to a much better start than second place Jaime Alguersuari. Sebastian Buemi was on pole position for the race, but Heidfeld went around the outside, despite Alguersuari actually power sliding into him through turn one, and Heidfeld was in second place trying. It was a bit of a Buemi train early on, but then after the safety car, essentially all hell broke loose.
Yeah, so
there was a big safety car after Karun Chanhok's car had a suspension failure through the last chicane, which caused a lot of problems. There was already a qualifying controversy with Nick Heidfeld qualifying third, despite clearly cutting the final chicane and driving over the bollard, which I thought was just hilarious.
Like, yeah, if you try to pull that off in the OAR, oh my god.
Yeah, like, there's no way it was getting away with that in Formula 1, but yeah, in case you guys don't know, in Formula E, during qualifying, they put the top three in a special hub. So they do. In case you didn't know, there's 20 drivers in Formula E. Because of the nature of the track and how small it is, it's only a 1 minute 10 second lap for this track in particular, for example. what they were doing was they were having to do qualifying five at a time, so you had four groups of five. And Sam Bird was in third place in qualifying right up until the last group of four, which included John Eric Vern, who obviously stunned everybody in Uruguay. And then Heidenfeld cuts the chicane, qualifies in third, sets the fastest last sector of anyone, and then Sam Bird literally storms out of the free, sees the video camera, and is absolutely livid afterwards, after seeing Heidenfeld's cut, which I thought was just hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why they didn't call that, why they didn't scrap his lap, because that cut was insane. We should not allow that to be classified as somebody's qualifying lap.
Yeah, that was a good tenth, maybe tenth and a half, maybe even a little bit more by cutting that final chicane, but Heidenfeld got away with it. Karma came back to get him later in the race, but Chanhok retired, big safety car, which caused a lot of confusion, mainly because, I think this is just a Formula E problem in general, really, where because pit stops have a mandatory pit limit, and because essentially it was 1 minute 10 was the minimum limit, so you've got to be in the pits for at least 1 minute and 10 seconds for safety reasons. And the thing was, because 1 minute 10 was essentially a racing lap around the place, like, by the time Alex Suarez was first in, and he was essentially a lap down by the time he came out. And then the safety car came out, so the whole field was slowing down, so they had to completely rejig the entire order of the safety car at that point. It was like watching a Formula One race around 2006.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost like everyone was pretty sure a safety car was going to happen.
Pretty much.
I know Dario Franchitti, the color commentator for Formula E, has felt very strongly that the cars are pretty fragile, especially on these rough city streets, that the suspension is going to fail on somebody's car at least once during the race.
Not to mention there was four in Uruguay last round out as well.
Yeah, I mean, I like that it's basically that unpredictable, but we kind of don't want to see cars go out for something that we know is going to happen.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's going to be a suspension fail. It doesn't mean we want to see it. Like, jeez, because after the safety car came in, we had Sebastian Buemi, who was leading the race, drive over the bollard and break his car. And that was the end of Buemi's race, and then which caused the hilarious scene of in the pit lane that the director has cut to the APT team chanting their minds off because all of a sudden Lucas Degrassi had gone from qualifying in fifth to leading the race, and him being championship leader was funny enough. And then all of a sudden, two laps later, suspension failure, Degrassi's out, and they cut back to the garage and they're all looking dejected. Hilarious scene.
Instant karma
right there. The racing gods did not smile kindly upon this. And next thing you know, the grass is in the gravel, and or in the wall, I should say, for cutting that last chicane, or not cutting last chicane, but basically having a suspension push rod failure, and that was that. That was the end of his day. Not a good result for the APT team, who ended up scoring a double donut, because we had further down the field, we had Sam Bird, who would, during his pit stop, drive out of the pit lane while the pit lane exit was closed.
Shades of Max Chilton.
Yep, he's following in his Max Chilton footsteps by leaving a closed pit lane. Whoops. Turns out he still finished in 7th, though, despite the drive-through penalty, and actually got the fastest lap of the race as well, so he clocked up the 2-point bonus where that was concerned. And then, just when we thought, after Degrassi's crash, Nick Heidenfeld was finally going to win something. Nope. Drive-through penalty for not having his pit lane limiter turned on. Whoops.
That's like a rookie mistake.
Like, has Nick Heidenfeld killed someone in a previous life?
I have no idea. He just can't get a break.
The man could not catch a break. Like, round one in Beijing, he should probably have won. Nico Prost didn't see him, turns into him, scores 0. Malaysia gets taken out by Montagne, into the wall. No points there. Finishes, I think it was 9th or 8th in Argentina after getting a drive-through for breaking the minimum pit lane time limit. And now in this race, he gets another drive-through. another drive-through for not having his pit lane limiter turned on, so I think he ended up finishing in ninth place, Heinfeld. Would you believe one of the strongest drivers in the field is 17th in the championship with only, I think, 3 points at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a common trend in Formula E where drivers are really fast on track, but they just make foolish errors or just face technical difficulties.
Yeah, pretty much. When it comes to things like that, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. Yeah, poor old Nick Heinfeld suffering, having just dreadful luck. John Eric Verne, who was in there, who surprised everybody with how great he looked in Uruguay. Not quite as comfortable a time this time around, but he still finished in a sixth place after a bit of a scrappy exchange at the end, where him and Nico Prost had banged wheels and there was a lot of contact on the final lap. It seemed that Verne's car was down on power at the end.
Yeah. Especially, who do you make contact with? I think it was Nico Prost when a car just basically flown past him and he tried to dive bomb back past into a corner and just made contact.
Yeah, and then Verne pretty much gives him the pole position finger as he's driving past him afterwards. Yeah, like that was totally your fault, Prost. You didn't give me the room.
Like,
well, you didn't die from 20 meters back.
To be honest, for as much as people say, oh, these things aren't fast, it seems like no one has control over their cars or has no idea how to drive these things.
Yeah, like, these cars have clearly got a fair amount of torque in them because they keep getting the backs out. There's a lot of power sliding going on. It's clearly these cars are not the easiest thing in the world to control. And, you know, despite the lack of speed as people might want to accuse the series of having, it's certainly causing some unpredictable moments out there, and like pretty much the entire midfield scrap in the second half of the race kind of proves that. Daniel Abt flying as well, I think on the penultimate lap, Daniel Abt getting the braking completely wrong for the penultimate corner, and he torpedoes the side of Jaime Alguersuari's car.
Yeah, it's like, these cars can be pretty unpredictable under braking, they're pretty tail happy, and they only race at street circuits, so the walls are right there. So when you make a mistake, you're probably going to hit a wall or another car, and as Abt found out, you can hit another car pretty easily.
Yeah, poor old Daniel Abt in tears and in shock on the side of the track after that crash where his car bit the bullet. Jaime Alguersuari managed to limp his car back home to finish in fifth in the end. Oh, and again, what was just a ridiculous last lap fight between, I think it was Nelson Piquet Jr., who ended up finishing a sneaky third, believe it or not, which nobody saw coming. Piquet was there, you had Prost that was there, Alguersuari and Verne, all dice in for the minor points, which made for great television right at the end of the Grand Prix as well. But the big winner from all the obviously from all the distractions and the incidents and the penalties and whatnot was Antonio Felix da Costa, who won the race. Nico Prost in second, and Nelson Piquet with his second podium in third. So Degrassi still maintains his championship lead over Buemi, and I believe Nelson Piquet is now third in the championship, isn't he?
We'd have to look at the standings, but it's actually...
No, sorry, I said it back. Sam Bird is, I think, actually. I'm pretty sure Sam Bird is third.
Yeah, it's like...
Nah, think about it.
Do you think they're going to be able to catch Lucas Degrassi? I know next race would be halfway in the championship, but it seems like, despite not being able to finish this race, Degrassi is still 10 points clear of Sam Bird in second.
Yeah, okay, so Sam Bird's in second, my bad. But, you know, they might do. It will come down a lot to reliability and driver mistakes and whatnot. Because, like I said, it's all street circuits. You know, you leave the door open for that kind of thing. But you're right, we've only six rounds to play for now. I mean, let's not put too much stock into the championship leaderboard right now as it stands, because it's a rookie series, it's his first year, it's going to be a little bit all over the place, the cars are a little bit all over the place in terms of reliability, so like I'd say we tread with caution where that's concerned.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, one of the statements that actually caught me off guard this weekend, on Saturday, Alejandro Aigag said that he hopes that Sebastian Vettel will race in Formula E one day.
I'm not so convinced on that one.
Like quote from Aigag, that we're big admirers of Sebastian Vettel. He He just doesn't like Formula E. Maybe one day we can convince him to come. People don't think the car's as quick or as cool. We respect what Vettel thinks, but I also respect what team owner Alain Prost says, that basically Formula E will basically become successful in about 2 years' time, and how that they're looking to have four, maybe five manufacturers for next season and the season afterwards, which is insane to see this championship grow that quickly.
That's unbelievable if what Alan is saying is true, and we could have five different manufacturers next year. That would be insane. You'd have true competition. You'd have a range of teams trying to get in there. I'm stunned at how well the series is going. I mean, yeah, the excitement of the championship has definitely helped in that, but it's clear that people are liking what they're seeing, at least.
Yeah, I remember before the series even officially launched, everyone says it's going to be garbage, there's going to be no sound, the racing's going to be boring, it's going to be slow. We're definitely not seeing that.
Wrong, 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 and wrong. Seriously, this might be the best series in motorsport right now, and that's alarming after just four races, how Formula E has been able to be so captivating, and it's been astonishingly good, this series. Like, I not in my wildest dreams did I think this series would be this good after just four rounds, and is doing a truly incredible job, in my opinion. So, props to Alejandro Agag. He's doing a brilliant job over there, and let's hope the excitement can continue, because there generally seems to be a, pardon the pun, but some buzz around this series at the moment. And after that race in Argentina, I can't really say you can blame them, because, I mean, you could be a motorsport fan of anything and sit down and be thoroughly captivated by that race in Argentina. If you haven't already, go and see it. The full thing is on YouTube for free. There's no excuse. Stick it on your TV. It's less than an hour long. Just do it, because it was a cracker.
Like, that's what Formula E does best. It plays to its strength. The races aren't too long. The circuits, they seem to schedule circuits that fit the cars, not circuits that look exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It's like looking at the Buenos Aires circuit, you wouldn't think that, oh, this is an amazing racetrack. This is Spa-Francorchamps. No. Formula E can't go to Spa because cars aren't that fast. They go to nice, small, tight circuits. They know the cars are going to look fast. They can race well against each other. And that's what we see out there.
Yep, and that's part of the reason why this series seemingly can do no wrong at the moment. It knows what it is. It knows its strengths, it knows its weaknesses, it's working to improve them. You know, we've had less sound on the replay cams, we've had, you know, they've got rid of the formation lap, we mentioned this before, how they've got rid of that to speed up the process of the race, and I'm sure they're still working on some things here and there, and obviously nothing's going to be perfect in year one, but I think for what they've got, I think they're doing an exceptional job.
Yeah, I mean, I would compare this to being like the 2020 of motorsport.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I mean, they are they're doing way better than I anticipated they would. And I went to their global launch in London about 6 months ago, and I saw the teams. I chatted with a couple of the drivers. I chatted with Catherine Legg. I had a chat with Sam Bird, and they all seemed genuinely very excited by what was going on. And you can tell they weren't hamming it up. They genuinely believed this was going to happen. And you know, their faith has been rewarded, because they're doing a brilliant job at the moment, and you know, the driver lineup's been great. I mean, you know, I still don't think the women should be there, because Tsukeda Cerruti and Catherine Legg haven't been very good, to be honest. But you know, if we've had a good mix of experience, we've had younger stars come through, guys we know and seem to like, and you know, also some up and comers as well. We've had some good names as well. We've got John Erik Vern come over, which is a big pull, and that was announced today. He's staying with Andretti for the rest of the season, which is great news. So you know, you've got another blue chip talent there in John Erik Vern, which is, you know, a guy that many people still believe should be in Formula One. So overall, I mean, this series can seemingly do no wrong at the moment.
Yeah, but it seems up and up. And based on where they're going. Based on where they're going for the rest of the season, it doesn't look like they can have a bad race. Next up, we have the two American rounds, Miami, and of course, legendary Long Beach. Then we have Monaco, then Tempelhof Airport in Berlin, then season finale in London at Battersea Park.
I've got to go to Battersea Park and see this race now. I've got to go. Before I thought, you know what, maybe if it's decent, I'm not going to. Now it's a must do. Like, I've got to go London and watch this race now, because this series is just doing a brilliant, brilliant job. And it's like I want to support it by giving them my money. So, you know, why the hell not? Essentially, because this series keeps producing races like this. Formula One's going to have a legitimate rival in terms of viewership, like at least in the short term, because considering the series is on ITV4 in the UK, which is a cable channel and a Freeview channel, it did over 250,000 viewers in a pretty late slot on Saturday night on a channel which not many people normally watch. So the ratings are doing excellently as well. They had almost as many viewers as they had during their season opener in Beijing. So that says a lot about the series' popularity. The word is definitely spreading. So, again, massive props to Formula E on this.
Yeah, I mean, the viewership's going to get bigger and bigger as the season goes on, because it's highly unlikely that any driver's just going to magically start dominating.
No, remember, they're all in the same car at the end of the day, and it's becoming clear that it's a matter of setup, and it's a matter of, you know, who's good on the day that's just going to benefit more than anything else. So it's clear there's no standout top driver at the moment. Like, Buemi's had his moments, Prost's had his moments, Heinfeld's looked good on occasion, Verne surprised everybody on his debut, Sam Bird dominated in Malaysia. So there's no standout guy at the moment, which definitely helps in terms of intrigue as well.
Yeah, because right now it's still anyone's game, because I think down to Jaime Alguersuari in seventh place, everyone's still within 25 points of first.
Yep. So, a lot of drama where that's concerned. So keep an eye on that, and I'm looking forward to Miami in a couple of weeks' time. The only minor black mark on the series is we've lost a driver, and that's Frank Montagne, who got busted after admitting he was taking cocaine during the Grand Prix weekend in Malaysia a few months ago. Disappointing to hear, King.
Yeah, disappointing to hear. But, I mean, it's sad, because probably Frank's going to face at least a two-year suspension. But it was kind of convenient for Andretti, because Montagne was driving the 27 car at the time. He ended up driving in the next round afterwards, and then was eventually replaced by Jean-Eric Vergne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of done them a favor, because Vergne ended up being so good and isn't immediately a top tier runner in Formula E by the looks of it, going by his two round performances so far. But a 2 year ban? I mean, this is rare. Like, you don't normally get incidents like this in motorsport in general. Like, how often do you hear of doping in racing? That's normally a track and field, an NFL, a baseball thing. Not so, normally something you'd hear in motorsport, right?
Yeah, because for most parts, doping outside of athletic sports, like in motorsports, usually recreational drug use, not performance enhancing. So you rarely see it. Maybe like a handful of occasions in NASCAR, but that's pretty much it.
And especially for a European guy as well, because, I mean, I have to go back. I think Thomas Enger was the last guy to really suffer a doping incident in Formula One. I think that was back in 2005, I think that was. So you're looking at a decade ago, and I can't remember any other cases since then. And, you know, the big profile ones tend to be in other sports, like cycling, which has had massive amounts of doping problems for years and years and years. And, you know, we mentioned track and field, we mentioned just athletic sports in general. You get a lot of doping, some more than others, but for this to be a thing, yeah, very rare indeed. And it's looking like a 2 year ban for at least for Frank, and that's a shame, because given he's 37 years old, that might be the end of his career.
But he openly admitted to doing it. No one forced him to say, yeah, I've been caught and I'm going to be banned. He openly admitted to it. And I'm surprised how some have reacted, especially Mario Andretti, grandfather of IndyCar and Formula E driver Marco Andretti, mm-hmm. and father of Michael Andretti, team owner. How Mario has said that Frank should be banned for life.
I'm not entirely sure it's a lifetime. I think a lifetime ban's too much. I think, given that, you know, there's a lot of peer pressure involved in the world, and given sometimes you can take drugs without even realizing. I mean, you know, how many athletes have doped in track and field for stuff they didn't even realize was in something? I remember, like, in the Winter Olympics where Alan Baxter famously got a bronze in the skiing, but it turns out because he had Vicks Vapor Rub, that was illegal, and he lost his bronze medal as a result. So it's, yeah, like, it's happened on so many occasions where, like, sometimes you don't even realize something is banned. You've got to be so, so careful sometimes. I'm not saying it's okay, because I think a lot of times it is on purpose, don't get me wrong. But sometimes it's a complete accident, and to be banned for life for that, I think, is incredibly harsh.
Yeah, a lifetime ban rarely happens in most sports. It takes a lot to be banned for life.
Exactly, and that's probably for the best, because if we had a one strike and you're out system, sport in general would be a very different landscape, and that's probably a good thing. So, you know, most of the time in track and field, it's two. And you get a lifetime ban. I know baseball, well, I think it's four from what we said before. We started taping the podcast, and, you know, obviously it varies across the board. There was a lot of controversy with Dwayne Chambers in the track and field for British Athletics a couple of years ago when he was banned from entering the Olympics, even though he'd only been done once, while guys like Justin Gatlin was able to go, despite having been caught for doping twice, and that was A-okay, and he ended up coming home with a bronze medal, which didn't help. So, you know, there's a lot of rules and regulations when it comes to these things. But yeah, just a very unfortunate incident, really. And you know, I hope it was just a one off for Frank. I hope there wasn't any deeper line meaning to that, like with John Jones, you may have heard in mixed martial arts getting done for drugs as well, which is again very unfortunate. And you know, that's a man with three daughters at home, and you know, that's just not good for his family at all. And again, I hope, if it is, I mean, he checked into rehab, so obviously I wish Jones the best, and you know, I hope he gets the help he needs, but just, you know, just a small black mark on an otherwise excellent series, which if you're not watching, you bloody well should be. I don't see why you wouldn't be right now. I don't see any reason why you could not enjoy this series, to be honest with you. So if you haven't already, do it. Everything's on YouTube. Like, you can't miss that. It's ridiculous. So let's move on real quick. And yeah, let's talk about the engine regulations. And it turns out, to a degree, at least not a massive one, but maybe a little bit less than we all realized, it turns out, due to a loophole in the FIA rules, we are indeed allowed to develop engines in season, King.
Yeah, I mean, the loophole seems pretty, like, it seems very arbitrary for a loophole. The loophole was that, usually for engine homologation, there's a deadline set in place in regulations. Last year was February 28th. This year, it was going to be February 28th. They just never got around to actually putting it into the regulations. And I know Ferrari and Renault have pointed that out, and the FIA have pretty much just accepted that there won't be a homologation deadline this season.
Yep, so there is no deadline, so that means you can, to an extent, develop during the season, yeah?
Yeah, to a degree that you can basically delay upgrades until then. If you choose to homologate later, you have to use 2014 engines up until that point. And then once you homologate the new design, all the cars that are currently running the 2014 engines have to change their engines to newer 2015 engines.
So yeah, you can't have any more than one homologated engine running at any one time. So if the guys in charge switch, so does everybody else, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's in case you guys didn't know, that's how it works. Because let's be honest, there's a lot of things that don't get discussed in these FIA details that I know a lot of people can spin them out of control, and it's like, oh, we can develop in season, they're going to catch Mercedes now. Probably not going to happen.
Yeah, because Mercedes can do the same thing.
Yeah, because Mercs can do the same thing. And essentially, I believe there's and you know, something to bear in mind as well, that remember, you're only allowed 4 power units this year as well. So given the fact there's a 19 race calendar, at least 3 of their engines are going to have to do 5 races.
Yeah, a lot of the people, many have said that it would basically be an agreement between the teams using one engine to say, yeah, when we go to Europe, that's when we're going to just homologate the engines. That's been a rumor that's been going around that they're just basically going to agree on a race that, yeah, we're all going to just change engines at that one time. And hopefully before then, no one blows one up.
Yeah, exactly. Because, yeah, I mean, you don't want to be lagging behind in the engine department this year because, like I said, you've got to be so stringent now because, like I said, our engine's going to have to last 5 full weekends, and that's a lot of running time. That's 1,500 kilometers alone. That's just in races. You're not talking about qualifying or the practice sessions either, and any testing that gets involved before the season starts as well. So it's a lot of runtime, and you know, I'm not sure that should be a thing. I think they should be trying to add more engines rather than less, given the fact that a lot of teams got into trouble when it came to engine regulations, especially the Renault runners of Lotus, Toro Rosso, and Red Bull. Vettel used 6 engines, and I know Kvyat used 6. I think Grosjean did as well. So not a good look, really, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully the upgrades will mainly be centered on reliability for the Renault runners, but they're also down on power, so...
Mm-hmm.
And development is still limited through the token system. They can only use 32 development tokens when they upgrade, so they're still limited as they were before. They just have more time.
So yeah, so quickly explain the token system real quick for those who don't quite know.
Well, each power unit design is split into 42 different parts, and they're each weighted. They're weighted on a scale from 1 to 3 tokens. So in total, all the parts together are valued at 66 tokens. During this off season and now past the deadline date into the season, they can only work on 32 tokens worth of areas in the power unit.
Okay, so yeah, that's essentially the system and how it works real quick. So, in case you didn't know, so you're only allowed to develop, what was it, 32 you said?
Yeah, 32 tokens worth.
32 tokens worth, so about roughly half the engine, essentially.
Yep.
Okay, so yeah, just to give you a rough idea about how that works. Hang on, Ryan, quickly pause your recording 1 second, mate. Go. And yeah, so on top of that as well, we've also got to mention that Honda have obviously... And what role they play in this, with Honda becoming in as a new supplier as well. Some are mentioning that they may have an advantage by being on the sidelines and whatnot, and they have not been given this same proviso where they can develop in season to a degree. And why is that, King?
Well, it's mainly because, as I said earlier, before they introduce the new spec engine, when they homologate in the middle of season, teams will be running old spec engines that they homologated before the start of last season. Obviously, Honda, as a new manufacturer, doesn't have a 2014 engine to run
until
then.
Yeah, so they've got nothing to base it on. Well, they can't really give you the same proviso, because we have no idea what Honda even have to this point. So, probably for the best. I mean, I think no matter which way you look at it, I think Honda were going to lose out on this one, whatever happened.
Yeah, because it's basically you're going to have the hand that you're dealt, especially coming in as a new manufacturer.
Exactly. So in some way, somebody was going to miss out on this one, and it just so happened to be Honda in this case, because there's no fair system to this one for a new team coming in, and it's just how Formula One is sometimes. So you know, what do you make of Honda's chances next year then, given this proviso?
Well, what do you mean next year? I mean 2015?
You know.
Well, I'd have to wait until after. I'd have to wait until the first race to honestly see. Because unlike the other teams, Honda still has access to all 66 tokens. They can do whatever they want until the homologation day.
Indeed. So there's a small plus where that's concerned for them, at least. They don't have the development token limit. So, I mean... You can't really go by the Abu Dhabi test, where they only ran about 15 laps or so, or something, some ridiculously low number like that, which it sounded nice, but it didn't really move very much, unfortunately. So hopefully Honda would have developed something a bit more reliable by then, hopefully. But yeah, we'll see a lot more of that during the testing in just in about 20 days' time now, February 1st in Jerez.
Yeah, so about... That's good. Yeah, and another thing that should be said, that before the homologation date, there's 10 days of testing before February 28th.
10 days.
And a lot of people kind of forget that the engine freeze, you know, the limiting of tokens, it's based on when you start in the formula, not when the current engine formula began. So for 2016, when everyone's limited to 25 tokens, Honda will have 32 tokens.
So they're always going to be a year behind in that regard.
Yeah.
I see. I did not know. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages of coming in as a new manufacturer. You get more development freedom than the other teams because you started later.
That's the way of trying to get you, trying to get a catch up. That's actually a pretty neat idea now I think about it. So yeah, that's definitely a plus where that's concerned. So yeah, hopefully Honda won't have too much of a problem trying to sort out McLaren's chances for next year. But let's move on real quick and let's talk about these super license changes. Big deal this one, a very controversial talking point, and essentially the FIA, what they're doing in response, I mean, they would never admit it flat out, but let's be real here, this is a response to Max Verstappen becoming an F1 driver at 17 years old. Basically the way of revamping how drivers can get an F1 super license and how to get into Formula 1, they've announced a rather radical new scoring system to get into Formula 1 now, King.
I would say Max Verstappen is the reason why this is happening now, but the FIA has probably wanted to do this for a while now, and this is kind of a good reason to just launch into
it. We're kind of half thinking about this one. Oh god, as a 17-year-old, shit. It's like, god, it's like now, this out here. These guys are taking the piss. Like, we have a kid with acne in Formula 1. Can't have that. It's a pretty sweeping change rather than just about having 300 kilometers of runtime on your license these days. Now it's a lot more complicated than that. So, correct me if I'm wrong in any of this, King. So, essentially, you've got to be, one, over the age of 18. You've got to, two, have done at least 2 years in a single-seated formula, right? Yep. And I believe you have to have amassed 40... points over the last 3 years of you being in racing to be eligible. Yeah.
Yes, and have a driver's license.
The little things. So, how is this scoring system working? You're asking. If you've already seen my Drake TV episode on super license changes, you'll probably already know this. But if you haven't already, a quick rundown of essentially the leagues that are eligible for scoring. Not a good sign when the first word you read in this list is future. The future FIA Formula 2 Championship is right at the top of the pile with 60 points. Then it goes down from 60 into second place for 50. 40 points for third, 30 points for fourth, and so on. 20, 10, 8, 6, 4, 3 into, as the top 10 goes down. And there's some high-level scorers here as well. We've got GP2, obviously the headlining feeder series of the FIA. 50 points if you're a champion in GP2. 40 for runner-up, and then goes down 30, 20, 10, 8, 6, 4. The rest of it's kind of F1 scoring, in case you didn't know already. The FIA European Formula 3, which is the very series that Max Verstappen graduated out of, is worth 40 if you win the championship, and then goes 30 and 20 downwards, as well as the same for the FIA's WEC, but that's only for LMP1 drivers at the very top of the tree. They get 40 for a championship win. Same for IndyCar, which we'll talk about in a minute as well, which is an interesting inclusion, being 40 points. Again, same rules there. Now, this is where it gets a little bit more interesting. GP3 is worth 30 points. The same as Formula Renault 3.5, which has caused a lot of controversy. The series that Carlos Sainz Jr. won just this past calendar year, and is going to be with Toro Rosso as Max Verstappen's teammate. So only 30 points for winning the Formula Renault 3.5 compared to 50 for winning in GP2. Japanese Super Formula is worth 20 points. The National FIA Formula 4 Championship, you may have heard that series do around recently with Mick Jr., Michael Schumacher's son, testing one of their cars lately, apparently, weighing worth 10 points, alongside the National Formula 3 Championship, which is worth 10, and Formula Renault Zero Cup, ALPS, and E Series are worth 5 each. So, yeah, a lot to take in. You may want to rewind the podcast and listen to all that again, just to make sure you've got everything. So feel free to do that. Done it? Cool, good, so we can continue. Right, so let's tackle the top of the mountain first here. The future FIA Formula 2 Championship is an interesting one. Isn't it? Isn't that right, Ron?
Yeah, I mean, this has kind of been... I mean, a Formula 2 has kind of been in the works to hopefully be around maybe in the next 5 years. But this is the first time the FIA has openly acknowledge that they want Formula 2 to return.
Yeah, it's like, it's not the most enticing name in the world, but it's, I think it's, the problem with it is that, yeah, it's on there, but we don't know the guise or the form of the format of Formula 2 yet, really, do we?
No. And, I mean, let me just read this quote from, Frederick Bertrand. He's a spokesperson for the FIA Single Seater Commission, the commission that's in charge of Formula 2. He said the target is to finish the ladder, and the time frame is still the next subject on our schedule. I'm sure this has been discussed with Stefano mm-hmm. Domenicali, the president of the commission. When he becomes president, this will be one of the main subjects on our to-do list. What we want to do is create a top-level category to follow on from Formula 3 and train drivers to be ready for Formula 1. But we don't want to say everything is done on Formula 3 and Formula 4. This is just the start. We will use the same recipe to do it, create Formula 2, with the involvement of the teams and support from them and the media.
The media? Not sure how they're going to get involved in that, but... So they've clearly got a vision here. They clearly want an FIA ladder of Formulas 2, 3, and 4 by the sounds of it, right? That's what it's definitely sound like. That's definitely the plan at this point. Have an official FIA cleaned out ladder. It seems a lot like Dorna and what they do with MotoGP, where they have MotoGP, Moto 2, Moto 3. Then you've got the Spanish CEV Moto 3 Championship as well. Britain has its own Moto 3 Championship as well. So there's clearly a ladder system there. It's defined. It works, unless you're Jack Miller, in which case you jump up two categories for no good reason. But that's a discussion for another podcast. But 60 points, that's clearly the plan. They want to build the emphasis on having a proper official feeder series. Does this mean the end of GP2?
Probably. I know Bertrand added at the end that it's probably going to be a merger, but they don't have the details on that yet. It'll probably be GP2 becomes Formula 2, or GP2 merges with Formula 3.5 and then becomes Formula 2, but they don't want to create a third top-level series. That is not on the table.
I think that's one of the biggest, one of the few problems with this system is that, essentially, I don't think you want it to be too top-heavy, because if it gets too top-heavy and you have 15, 20, 25 drivers a year that are eligible, it kind of defeats the point of the system, and it'll be basically back where we were last year, right?
Yeah, we're busy.
You get a super license. You get a super license. Everyone gets a super license.
As long as you race, you get a super license.
You tell them. So essentially, you know, you're in a situation where you don't want it to be too top heavy. You don't want like 15 different series giving out a big chunk of points, because it will essentially be where everybody gets in. That just muddies the waters, and we don't want that. So it makes sense. Oh, I mean, I know I've spoken about this on blog format as well, and I know King's, on our last taping, which didn't make it in, I call it the lost show, basically, we mentioned how, you know, essentially, like, the way I think Formula 2 is structured and formatted is going to be a big say as to whether this works or not.
Yeah, because I really think that formula, that basically single-seater racing needs a clean ladder, because it'll make it easier to watch the feeder series more. It'll encourage people to watch the feeder series more. Like, now you don't have this basically constellation of just numerous amounts of feeder series, not knowing, like, oh, is this one important,
like,
or not?
Well, where does Formula 3 fit into the grand scheme of things? Did you guys go to, like, my dad watched the Formula 3 race one time, Formula 3.5 race. He said, so did these guys get into Formula 1 afterwards? And I was like, well, maybe? Like, like, I couldn't give him a straight answer for that very reason you just mentioned. Like, is this one important? Is this isn't? So, you know, Like you said, you can see the vision, and you can see, like, what the plan is here. Like, having Formulas 1, 2, 3, and 4. I mean, that's as clear an answer as you could ever possibly imagine.
Yeah, it's straightforward. Yeah, it's numbers. Right.
Like, how could we possibly get that one mixed up? So I can see what they're doing there. I mean, is this also bad news for Formula Renault 3.5?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's bad news for GP2, but no one really cares.
GP2
about
is a mess. We all know GP2 is a mess of pay drivers, drivers who aren't very good, drivers who, in general, by the time they get to the top, have probably done 4 years and aren't that good anyway, and should be winning the series given experience. And yeah, GP2 is a bit of a mess. Like, let's be real with each other here. Like, Joelen Palmer won the series. He's not going to be in Formula One next year. And he can't race in GP2 again next year. Like, the whole champion removal system I've never really liked, only because Formula 1 seats are so rare to go around these days, and there just isn't that much out there, that essentially someone's missing out on something big, unfortunately. So I've never really liked GP2 for that reason, because it just feels kind of irrelevant to me, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, because it never seems like, it rarely ever seems that anyone actually gets to Formula 1 from GP2. Usually, if you get to Formula 1 from GP2, it's pretty much been understood that they were going to go to Formula 1 before they even showed up in GP2.
Yeah, like, Pastor, like, the fact that he had such a big paycheck behind him made it kind of obvious he was going to get in somewhere, given the nature of how Formula 1 has shifted and how we're heading towards an emphasis where money is almost as, if not more important than actual talents. And, you know, compared to a guy like maybe like Nico Hülkenberg, who did have to climb that ladder, won the GP2 championship. Did he get into Formula 1 straight away, 2009? I think he did, didn't he? He did, yeah. Lewis Hamilton was another one as well, but Lewis Hamilton was penciled in as the golden boy from day one, but, you know.
Yeah, he was an academy driver. Academy drivers and pay drivers, they always go straight through.
Hamilton was a prime example of that. If anything, Hamilton wanted to get in when he was like 20, if I'm not mistaken. And, like, yeah, that family knows what they're doing. Like, and the story. But did you see the story that came out today, King? I was going to talk for a minute about how Anthony Hamilton thinks Lewis is going to win the title like halfway through the year.
Yeah, I didn't read the story. I saw the headline and I was just in complete shock. And I was like, is someone just going to call this boring, like, right now?
Yeah, it's like, fuck, are we going to win this title in friggin', like, what do you call it now? We're going to win it in Monza. Yeah, like, 6 races to spare. Fuck it.
Yeah, but I mean, back to this whole ladder situation, I have this quote here from the sporting director of Christian Horner's super team, Arden, Julian Rose. Julian Rose says that there's some surprises in the system, but the idea is a positive one. I think it could help the junior categories on the whole, but obviously the new system will please some people and frustrate others. If it requires drivers to take a more structured route to Formula One, then hopefully that it can help the current situation with the junior categories.
Overall, I get where Julian's coming from, and I think I agree with what he was saying there for the most part. It is definitely a more structured, focused ladder. The problem with this is that, like, the net's very wide, and IndyCar, in my opinion, should not be worth 40 points. I think it should be worth more than that, because IndyCar is clearly the closest thing we've got to Formula 1 at the moment.
Yeah. It most, in terms of driver level in terms of just pure performance-wise when it comes to cars.
Yeah. Like, for me, IndyCar should be worth 60, the same as the FIA Formula 2, because IndyCar is as big as single-seat racing gets in America, quite frankly, when it comes to open-wheel stuff. And America is a market you should not ignore. America loves their motorsport. Like, why the hell would you, not, like, truly get behind that? So, IndyCar being worth 40, I think, is a bit of a shame. I think it should be worth 60. I think it should be worth a bit more than that. I know a lot of people got mad about Formula E not being mentioned. My response to that is essentially, it's a brand new series. Take a chill pill.
It's like a lot of the guys in Formula E already have super licenses.
We've already had 14 drivers in Formula E who have been in Formula One at some point in their careers and have super licenses. 14 out of 22 drivers who have taken part in this series so far. So, chill. Like, there's no need to mention Formula E in there yet. It's not a feeder series, and we shouldn't really consider it that one. It's always been more of an alternative to Formula One rather than something that's going to be like a Formula 2 or Formula 3 or whatever. It's not really like that, in my opinion. I think it's a separate series on its own merit, and I think it should be treated as such.
Yeah.
Formula Renault 3.5 is the one that sticks with a lot of people, because a lot of people I know are Formula Renault 3.5 fans. I know a lot of people are behind Carlos Sainz Jr., who came through that series. Kevin Magnussen came through that series. And one of the big arguments I've heard in general is that, oh, well, this guy wouldn't be in Formula 1 now if this system was in place, or et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's a bit of a bullshit argument, don't you think, King?
Yeah, like, as we see here with, like, the introduction of a Formula 2 championship, the junior categories are always changing in terms of whether which ones exist or not, the reputation level, the quality of driver. It's always constantly changing. That's why the FIA kind of wants to streamline it to begin with, so it's easier to keep track, especially if Formula Renault and GP2 are arguably on the same level when it comes to reputation. But driver quality is going to be higher in Formula Renault because it's so much cheaper to run in Formula Renault than in GP2.
It's all about the Benjamins, King. It's all about the Benjamins. And, yeah, like, essentially, you've got to remember, you're trying to get into the FIA, and I use that in bold capital letters, FIA Formula One World Championship. Why on earth would they give more points to a series that isn't one of its own? That's just the reality of business and sports and whatnot. Like, they're never going to put Formula Renault 3.5 on an equal footing to anything that comes out of their own name anyway, you know? Hence why IndyCar's probably only worth 40.
With the FIA, IndyCar has a pretty good history, but mainly with Formula One, they don't have
exactly a good history. You know, 40 is reasonable. So champion automatically gets in. If you're a top title contender for a couple of years, you'll probably get in eventually as well. I mean, it's not bad. I think it could have been a little bit better. Formula Renault 3.5 was never going to be on the same level. And honestly, I'm glad it isn't, because like I mentioned earlier, we don't want too many big tiers at the top. Otherwise, it just dilutes the waters and everybody gets a pass. So, you know, that being worth 30, if you're good enough in Formula Renault, you'll be eligible anyway with two 30-point seasons or a 20 and a 30 or something like that. I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, I don't think it's going to kill Formula Renault by any instance, but it's certainly going to make teams and sponsors lean towards something else, right?
Yeah, but I mean, the big teams are in both, like Arden, Christian Horner's super team. They're in GP2 and Formula Renault 3.5, and also have a team in MSA Formula, which is the FIA British Formula 4.
So yeah, Christian Horner's got a lot of fingers and a lot of pies. So essentially, yeah, like something was going to miss out here. So and it was always going to be one of, I think it was going to be somebody else's problem more than anything else. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't see what the problem is, really. And, I think that's a bit of a minor complaint. Everything else, I think, is pretty much straightforward. Like, Japan gets some props, which is always nice to see. Look at guys like Andre Lotterer, who has had great success single-seater racing in Japan, for instance, and now he's a three-time Le Mans winner, and now Formula One driver, too, because he's got terrific Caterham last year. So, I'm glad Japan's getting the props it needs.
And that's where Michael Schumacher drove open-wheel racing
exactly.
before he went to Formula
so,
1.
So, it's proof that it can be successful, so why not, you know? And 20 points is a good number. So, I think for what it is, you know, the national championships are there as well. So, overall, I think it's a pretty good system, King.
I mean, to me, I want to say it's a great system, but I kind of have to wait for Formula 2 to say
like,
it's great.
For me, like, the concept is great, and I think it's a big improvement on what they used to have. And, like, the execution isn't quite there yet. I think, like you said, Ryan, I think a lot of it will eventually boil down to the format, the structure of Formula 2 and how that pans out, and we'll see when the time comes. I'm sure we'll have another conversation on that. But I think it works. I think they've got it just about right. I mean, there's not a lot I don't like about this at the moment. And I think it's definitely, on the whole, I think a positive.
It's just going to depend on which series are going to be the ones to disappear
from this
list.
That could very well be a thing. That could very well be a thing eventually. I mean, Formula Renault 3.5. Apparently Renault are talking to the FIA about this soon, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, the FIA is going to be meeting with a lot of manufacturers soon. It's going to be Renault, Honda.
There's going to be a lot of angry people in that boardroom.
I think it's going to be, when Renault shows up, it's just going to be a conversation on whether a merger is going to happen.
Yeah, it's like Renault,
not.
It's probably for the best if you just merge series here. Like, just swallow your losses and go, because no one's going to drive in their series if a Formula 3 title is going to be worth the same number of points, if not more, because the FIA Formula 3 is worth 40, so champion automatically gets in. And while, you know, Formula Renault 3.5, it wouldn't make any sense in a couple of years' time to drive in Formula Renault 3.5, because if you're of that standard, you probably should be in Formula 3 anyway, right? Because it offers more points.
Yeah.
So it just wouldn't make any sense racing in Formula Renault 3.5. Have a bigger chance for yourself and get into Formula 3. If you think you're that good, you'll probably do well anyway. So, you know, overall, I think it's a very good system. I think a lot of fans were bitching about this. And I think, to me, personally, I think a lot of people are focusing on the one step back rather than the three steps forward. And I think, overall, I like where this is going. It's going to weed out a lot of the pay drivers, because now you've got to be pretty darn good to get 40 points and be eligible. You have to have been either a championship winner on the ladder system somewhere, or have been a strong title contender over 2 or 3 years in a period to be eligible. Isn't that kind of what we want, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we want. You can't automatically just jump up to Formula 1. You need at least 2 seasons. And, I mean, it basically solves most of the problems.
Like, I know, like, this is definitely a proactive switch. And, like, it's not quite finished yet, but we've got plenty of time to refine it. It's not actually in place officially until 2016. And I know David Coulthard came out today and said, I mean, there needs to be provisos and there needs to be exceptions made for exceptional talent. Well, if you're an exceptional talent, you're going to get the points anyway. So I don't see what the problem is. Like,
Unless you want them to move up to Formula 1 after one season.
And you know
season.
What, that isn't really necessary most of the time. Like, why can't you do another year? Like, are we that impatient to see you? Like, I don't think anyone on the ladder circuit right now is Marc Marquez. Let's put it that way. And even Marquez did 2 years.
Yeah. It's like, if you start racing when you're 16... By the time you're 18, you're going to have your super license, so there's no need to rush.
What's the hurry here, people? Like, we don't like it when young guys get in the car. There's been a lot of backlash to Max Verstappen as it is, as a 17-year-old, so what's the hurry here, people? Like, most F1 drivers are debuting at 20, 21, 22 these days, so I don't see what the issue is, really, at all. And, you know, if you're on the circuit and on the ladder at 17, 18, and you're that good, you'll get there. So I don't see what the problem is. So, yeah, overall, I think it's a great move. And, you know, obviously, I think a lot of that is dependent on Formula 2. But I think, for the most part, I like where it's going. So to wrap up this show, we're going to have the obligatory Ryan King. Go for it, mate.
first time not on the finish line. Here's the Susie Wolf update.
Woohoo! We're stealing your gimmick, athlete. We're stealing your gimmick. Copyright infringement, bitch.
Well,
right.
Well, obviously, recently there was the Race for Champions in Barbados this year, and Susie Wolf made an appearance on
Woohoo! Wait, what?
Yeah, I mean, she was paired alongside David Coulthard against, you know, the likes of, for Australia, you had Jamie Wincup and McDowin. Barbados even had their two local drivers entered in.
Hooray for the locals.
Oh, who the United States have? I know the United States had Ryder Hunter Ray.
Yeah, I recognize that one, the Indy 500 one from last year.
Yeah, I mean, she was probably the only non-champion in the Race of Champions because the Barbadian drivers were the Barbados Rally Club champions.
Let's be real here. The name of the event is called Race of Champions. When was the last time Susie Wolf was a champion in anything?
Not in an actual car. Maybe in a cart.
Yeah, point proven there, folks. Point proven. Oh, dear. And yet, she was invited.
Yeah.
Why was she chosen to represent Team GB? Was Lewis Hamilton unavailable? Like, we couldn't even give Max Chilton a call.
Yeah, against the lines. Like, the United States somehow got Kurt Busch and Ryan
Hunter Ray. Yeah, that's a pretty darn good team. Like, that's about as good as you could get out of America, really.
And France had Romain Grosjean and the reigning Formula 3 European champion Sebastian Ocon.
And Romain Grosjean, didn't he win the event last year? Yeah. Or 2013, yeah. So the reigning Race of Champions champion Romain Grosjean there representing the Vive la France.
So, and there was a Nordic team from, you know, the Nordic countries where you had Peter Solberg.
Now that's a team. That's a proper team. Mr. Le Mans and Peter Solberg, who was a hero of mine growing up.
So it's like Susie Wolf was against extremely
stiff
competition.
And how did she fare, King?
She had 2 wins throughout the entire competition.
And who are those wins against?
One was against Dante Skeet, a local Barbadian driver, and the Australian motorcycle world champion McDowin.
She beat a local rally club driver from Barbados and McDowin, who made his name with 2 less wheels.
Yes.
People, please stop giving Susie Wolf work. Like, I'm sorry, she was dragging the team down. Somehow we still made the final, apparently, with David Coulthard on the other side of our team, because these old square jaws still got it, God bless him. But,
Britain ended up making the final of the Nations Cup and then losing to the Nordic
team.
God
damn it,
obviously.
Christensen!
And then DC went on to win the individual event. He ended up being
the
champion.
Yes, David Coulthard came down and showed up everybody. The man has been out of racing for like 5 years now. I love this sport sometimes.
And DC was not in an easy group to begin with. His group was him, Jamie Wincup, Romain Grosjean, and McDowin. Ended up beating all of them, 3 wins, no losses in the group. Then in the knockout stage, he faced Petter Solberg in the quarterfinals, won. Jamie Wincup again in the semifinals, won. Then Pascal Wehre in the Mercedes young driver, won in the final.
People, we love Susie Wolf here. Lovely woman. Great accent. Very easy on the eye. Great media personality. She should definitely get a full-time gig on Sky Sports. I think she would definitely be an improvement on Natalie Pinkham. Well, that's debatable, but...
Yeah.
That's debatable, but we'll save that for another discussion. But, essentially, people, stop giving her jobs. Like, we're talking about a mediocre DTM driver here who seemingly got in because her hubby happened to be owning Williams at the time. And, yeah, now she's getting Race of Champions gigs. like, as in, like, an all-star tournament of drivers, she made it in as a Great Britain representative? Like, really?
Yeah, and it's to the... Admittedly, there was a young drivers team, a young stars team, which was Pascal Wehrlein and Joel Palmer.
Well, at least Joel Palmer.
So
why couldn't Joel Palmer represent us then? Like, jeez. Like, Joel Palmer's actually half decent.
Like, Joel Palmer was actually worse than Susie Wolf.
Oh, Jesus, why did I just say that?
Yeah, I mean, in the race of champions, actually in the individual race of champions, neither of them had wins. But neither of them had wins, and in the Young Stars Cup, they both equaled out that only having. I mean, no, in the Nations Cup, Susie had her two wins, and Jolynn Palmer only had.
We
one
ain't
win.
Shit. We ain't shit on a global scale besides having the Formula 1, GP2, GP3, and WEC champions.
But Jolynn Palmer's one win was against Sebastian Ogier.
I guess that's a start, right? We'll take it. And on that note, we better close the show before I end up embarrassing myself more about how mediocre our set of world champions are, really. But, I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Hopefully you listened for the first time on iTunes. Yes, we're on iTunes, everybody. You can subscribe now. Just look up for the... Just search for Motorsport 101 and I'm sure you'll find us. So thanks to everybody for all the support for listening and great pleasure to be on iTunes. Massive thanks to Sasha and to Gina who have been former guest hosts as well. They're a part of the success too, so we've got to give them their due. Thanks to guys for that. If you really liked us, why don't you leave a rating and a customer review? That'd be wonderful. Thanks. If not, it'll be on the website as per usual as well. Ryan, give yourself a quick plug real quick, because I heard you changed your website address and all that.
My new site domain, theformulae.nyc, and also new Twitter handle for the website, formulae_NYC, and you could find me personally at Twitter at Ryan Eric King. We have a new episode of the Finish Line Podcast, which is out the moment we're recording this. So if you want to hear me talk more about Susie Wolf, engine loopholes and young driver point systems, you can go there.
Yeah,
and so listen
if you
for
like
it.
Your podcast with like 100% more American, you can head over there with Athlete, who is way too highbrow for IndyCar, apparently. I'm calling you out, Athlete.
Oh, dear.
I'm calling you out. Well, I want you on the show to discuss this. We're going to enjoy. You're going to have some redneck racing in your life, and you're going to enjoy it. If I'm watching IndyCar next year, you sure as hell are too. If you haven't already, check it out on harrison101.com. Obviously, the podcast website, everything you need is on there as well. And thanks, everybody, for listening. So, until next time, I've been harrison101. Thank you very much for listening. For me and Ryan King, take care now.
Bye.